जैया राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी, जैया राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी, गोपी जना भालावा गिरिभर धारे, गोपी जना भालावा गिरिभर धारे, यशोदा नंदना व्रज जना रंजना, यशोदा नंदना व्रज जना रंजना, यमुना तीर वनचारे, जमुना तीरा बनचारे, जैया राधा माधव कुंज बिहारे, जैया राधा माधव कुंज बिहारे, जय ओम विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राज गचार्य आशुतोत्तर शतशिशि माधि सिवाई वै सैसी भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी श्रील प्रभुपाद की जय ओम विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राज गचार्य आशुतोत्तर शतशिशि माधि सिवाई वै भक्ति सिद्धांत सरस्वती गोस्वामी महाराज श्रील प्रभुपाद की अनंत कोटि वैष्णव वृंद की इस्कॉन फाउंडर आचार्य श्रील प्रभुपाद की निरंतरा श्रीमं भागवतं की इताई गौर प्रेमनंदी. O glory to the assembled devotees. O glory to the assembled devotees. O glory to the assembled devotees. O glory to Shishi Guru and Shri Gauranga.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. So it's the last section of the chapter Lord Shiva Saves the Universe, Canto 8, Chapter 7, and we'll be covering texts 43 to 46, which will end the chapter. So 43 is the first verse, which I'll read, and then we can chant 44 together. So Tasyapi darashayam asha svaviryam jala kalmasaha chak chakara gale nilam tak cha sador vibhusanam. So the translation of text 43. As if in defamation, the poison born from the ocean of milk manifested its potency by marking Lord Shiva's neck with a bluish line. That line, however, is now accepted as an ornament of the Lord. In text 44. Tapyante loka tapena sadava prayaso janaha paramaradanam tadi purushasyayak datmanaha tapyante loka tapena sadava prayaso janaha paramadanam tadi purushasya kilatmanaha tapyante loka tapena sadava prayaso janaha paramadanam tadi purushasya akilatmanaha. Please chant. Tapyante lokatapena sadava prayaso janaha paramadanam tadi purushasya akilatmanaha. Tapyante lokatapena sadava prayaso janaha paramadanam tadi purushasya kilatmanaha. Tapyante lokatapena sadava prayaso janaha paramadanam tati purushasya kilatmanaha. Okay. The word for word, tapyante, voluntarily suffer. Lokatapena, because of the suffering of people in general. Sadava, saintly persons. Prayasaha, almost always. Janaha, such persons. Parama aradhanam, the topmost method of worshipping. Tat, that activity. He, indeed. Purushasya, of the Supreme Person. Akila Atmanaha, who is the super soul of everyone. Translation for text 44. It is said that great personalities almost always accept voluntary suffering because of the suffering of people in general. This is considered the highest method of worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is present in everyone's heart. In the purport. Here is an explanation of how those engaged in activities for the welfare of others are very quickly recognized by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Lord says in Bhagavad Gita 1868-69, Ya idam paramam guyam mat bhakteshu abhidasyati nacha tasman manusyeshu Kashrin Me Priya Krita Maha. One who preaches the message of Bhagavad Gita to his to my devotees is most dear to me. No one can excel him in satisfying me by worship. There are different kinds of welfare activities in this material world, but the supreme welfare activity is the spreading of Krishna consciousness. Other welfare activities cannot be effective, for the laws of nature and the results of karma cannot be checked. It is by destiny or the laws of karma that one must suffer or enjoy. For instance, if one is given a court order, he must accept it, whether it brings suffering or profit. Similarly, everyone is under obligation to karma and its reactions. No one can change this. Therefore, the Shastra says, Tasya maheto prayatena kavida na labhyate yad primatam upari adaha. That's Bhagavatam 1.5.18. One should endeavor for that which is never obtained by wandering up and down the universe as a result of the reactions of karma. What is that? One should endeavor to become Krishna's conscious. If one tries to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world, he should be understood to be performing the best welfare activity. The Lord is automatically very pleased with him. If the Lord is pleased with him, what is left for him to achieve? If one has been recognized by the Lord, even if he does not ask the Lord for anything, the Lord, who is within everyone, supplies him whatever he wants. This is also confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. Tesham natya biyakanam yoga shemam bahami aham. Again, as stated here, tapyante loka tapena sadava prayasa janaha. The best welfare activity is raising people to the platform of Krishna consciousness, since the conditioned souls are suffering only for want of Krishna consciousness. The Lord himself also comes to mitigate the suffering of humanity. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata adhyatanam adharamasya tadamanam sujami aham parityanaya sadanam vinashaya chaduskritim dharma samstapanayarta sambhavami yuge yuge. Whenever and whenever there is a decline in religious practice, O descendant of Bharata, and a predominant rise of irreligion, at that time I descend myself to deliver the pious and to annihilate the miscreants, as well as to re-establish the principles of religion. I advent myself millennium after millennium, Bhagavad Gita 4.7-8. All the Shastras conclude, therefore, that spreading the Krishna consciousness movement is the best welfare activity in the world. Because of the ultimate benefit this bestows upon people in general, the Lord very quickly recognizes such service performed by a devotee. And going on to text 45. Nishamya karma tak chambor deva devasya mithusa praja dakshayani brahma vaikuntas chasa samsire. Upon hearing of this act, everyone, including Bhavani, the daughter of Maharaj Daksha, Lord Brahma, Lord Vishnu, and the people in general, very highly praised this deed performed by Lord Shiva, who is worshipped by the demigods and who bestows benedictions upon the people. And text 46, Praskanam Pibataha Paner Yat kinchiv jagraha smatat virikshkahahi vishal sadhyo dandas satakas chaya pare. Translation: scorpions, cobras, poisonous drugs, and other animals whose bites are poisonous took the opportunity to drink whatever little poison had fallen and scattered from Lord Shiva's hand while he was drinking. Purport: mosquitoes, jackals, dogs, and other varieties of dandakshaka, or animals whose bites are poisonous, drank the poison of the Samudra Mantana. the churned ocean, since it was available after it fell from the palms of Lord Shiva. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purport of the 8th canto, 7th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Lord Shiva Saves the Universe by Drinking Poison. Om Agyana Timarandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Panchakalpatarubhyascha Kripasandubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So here we are, where Sukadeva Goswami is speaking, and earlier on Sukadeva Goswami had referred to Lord Shiva's, and these are his words, benevolent work for humanity. And also Sukadeva Goswami had referred to, again using his words, Lord Shiva compassionately drinking the whole palmful of poison. And now Sukadeva Goswami, in this particular verse that we chanted together, he's making a generalization, and he says that all great personalities almost always accept voluntary suffering because of the suffering of people in general. It's interesting, of course, that the suffering usually is understood to be a kind of bearing of some pain or bearing some distress or even undergoing some injury. And Lord Shiva, in this case, he actually undergoes a kind of injury. It's described in the verse where he seemed to have a bluish mark on his neck because the poison is so strong. So it's suspended in the neck, and it's actually making itself visible through a long blue line. So that's the injury one could say that Lord Shiva is experiencing, or that he's undergone. So Lord Shiva himself gives a reason for why he performs this act of drinking the palmful of poison, and he also gives the consequence of the act. So this is Lord Shiva's thinking, and it's very interesting because Lord Shiva is always referred to as a very great thinker. So he says, when one performs benevolent activities for others, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, is pleased. And when the Lord is pleased, I am also pleased, along with all other living creatures. Therefore, let me drink this poison, for all the living entities may thus become happy because of me. So those were Lord Shiva's words and his thought process. So his conclusion is that were he to drink the poison, all living entities could become happy. Srila Prabhupada, earlier on, he noted that Lord Shiva considers any great acts that he performs as being very unimportant. So we notice he said, all living entities are going to become happy because of me. But earlier on, we come to understand that any great act that Lord Shiva performs, he doesn't consider as being very important. And for example, or the example was given earlier on, that he destroyed the whole sacrifice that Daksha was performing. And so we can understand that the same mood would be there with regard to his counteracting this halahala poison or ingesting it, or at least keeping it within his throat. That action, of course, would be preventing that poison from spreading throughout the universe. But Lord Shiva's mood would be, it's not so important. Yet it remains a fact that all the demigods had been praying to Lord Shiva, even if it was done a little indirectly, that he please counteract the effects of the poison. So if we take a look at something of Lord Shiva's action, we could consider what happens when he's actually destroying that sacrifice of Daksha. So one of the things Lord Shiva does in that situation, he orders a gigantic demon. And this demon is as high as the sky. This is the description. He's bright as three suns combined. He has fearful teeth, and the hairs on his head are like burning fire. And he has thousands of arms equipped with various weapons. And he's also garlanded with the heads of men. So this is this gigantic demon that comes from the body of Lord Shiva, and that he then instructs to go and kill Daksha and his soldiers at the scene of the sacrifice. So what's of interest in this particular example of this particular act that Lord Shiva performed is that indeed this demon came, was born from the body of Lord Shiva, but in actual fact, he's understood to be the personified anger of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And at the same time, he's prepared to execute the orders of Lord Shiva. So if we take this situation where Lord Shiva has been asked by the demigods to drink this poison, the Kalakuta poison, we're understanding that the demigods are asking him because he's directly an incarnation of Lord Vishnu, and he's also Lord Vishnu's direct representative. So there's a corroboration for this particular understanding on the part of the demigods, and this is the particular words that are taken. Patim Vishvasyatmeshvaram Shashvatam Shivam Achutam, which translates into that the super soul is called by many names, of which Maheshvara, Shiva, and Achuta are especially mentioned. So something of the position of Lord Shiva is clarified here, which the demigods have an understanding of. That in many ways, just in the way that Lord Vishnu is the super soul, Lord Shiva is addressed that way because he's a direct representative of Lord Vishnu. Now, in this position of directly representing Lord Vishnu, the demigods have a particular view of Lord Shiva. And this is how they put it. And it's a very nice, concise description of Lord Shiva, the demigod's view of him. And these are their words. They say, situated in his perfection as the master of the senses, knowledge, fruit of activities, and the path of achieving perfection. He was the friend of the entire world, and by virtue of his full affection for everyone, he was very auspicious. This is a demigod's description of Lord Shiva. He's a master of the senses, master of knowledge, of fruitive activities, and the path of achieving perfection. And this is from Srimad Bhagavatam in the fourth canto, the sixth chapter, and the 30th verse. So of particular importance in relation to this act that Lord Shiva is going to perform, he's referred to as Adhishvara, or controller of the senses. Now, this is quite an extraordinary position to be in, because generally it requires elevation through wisdom and austerity for the senses to be purified. So this is the process. There has to be wisdom, there has to be austerity, and the senses become purified, and then one's able to engage directly in the service of the Lord or directly according to the instructions of Lord Vishnu or Super Soul. And Lord Shiva is in that position. And in this particular action of drinking the Kalakuta poison, he's teaching by his actions how to engage in devotional service. So it's an unusual position or an unusual act that Lord Shiva is performing, but particularly it's in order to teach everyone how to engage in devotional service. So the action performed by Lord Shiva in drinking the Halahala poison is an example of his showing what is that best welfare activity for all beings. Because that activity brings this condition of health, happiness, comfort, because there's the desire to please the Lord through the activity. So it's not merely that he's ingesting the poison to save the universe, although that obviously will be beneficial to everyone. It's also that his desire is to please the Lord through the activity. So hence, by performing that action with that particular desire, he's serving, the action is serving to show everyone how devotional service can be performed. So even with the risk of distress of some sort or having to bear some suffering, that action will be formed as an act of service to the Supreme Lord, because it was the instruction of Lord Vishnu for the demigods to make the request of Lord Shiva, and Lord Shiva, being so connected to the Super Soul, is taking it that he has to perform the action. Now, Srila Prabhupada quotes from Srimad Bhagavatam, the first canto, the fifth chapter, and the 18th verse, which we read in the purport. Tasyaiva heto prayateta kovida na labhyate yat brahmatam upari ashaha. And this translates into, persons who are actually intelligent and philosophically inclined should endeavor only for that purposeful end which is not obtainable even by wandering from the topmost planet, Brahmaloka, down to the lowest planet, Patala. As far as happiness derived from sense enjoyment is concerned, it can be obtained automatically in course of time, just as in the course of time we obtain miseries, even though we do not desire them. So this is a verse quoted by Srila Prabhupada. And what came to mind when I was reading this verse quoted by Srila Prabhupada, which is talking about this very purposeful end, which was that end that Lord Shiva is demonstrating of performing actions for the pleasure of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which is then going to be satisfying all living entities, or is working for the welfare of all living entities, bringing about that healthy, prosperous, happy condition for everyone. Another verse came to mind, which illustrates something of this purposeful end of worshipping the Supreme Lord. I think it was quoted also by Srila Prabhupada. Just made a note of it. I don't know where I put it. Anyway, seems I didn't write the verse, so let me continue. It was a verse from the, this particular verse, that's it. This particular verse that we're reading here is qualifying that purposeful end of worshiping the Supreme Lord. So if one's end is gratifying the senses, which the verse in the Bhagavatam that was just read says that that happiness that comes from gratifying the senses will be obtained automatically in the course of time, just as in the course of time miseries will come. So if one is working with that as one's purposeful end to find happiness, then one is naturally trying to avoid miseries. Now, this is completely contrary to the position taken where the purposeful end is the worship of the Supreme Lord. Because in that position where one's seen the one's purposeful end, the worship of the Supreme Lord, one will voluntarily take on suffering or misery. So it's a diametrically opposed position. And in connection with the same verse that Srila Prabhupada is quoting from the Bhagavatam, there's mentioned that, you know, if one's actually performing actions, sense gratificatory actions, which may even include pious activities, still one will be traveling from planetary system to planetary system. And Srila Prabhupada is particularly pointing out that it's the law of the Supreme Lord that the different planets, each planet is designed in such a way that a different grade of living entity resides in a particular planet. And this is the criterion for what allows a particular entity to reside on a particular planet is the good work that they've performed, the good work prescribed in the scriptures. So it means that a particular placement in a particular material circumstance, meaning by one's birth or one's education or bodily features, all of that is still changeable with that end of gratifying the senses in some way. So always the urge throughout the scriptures, or for those philosophically inclined persons, is to get into some permanent position. And that permanent position entails one where one is constantly blissful, constantly knowledgeable. Now, this particular point is illustrated very nicely by Lord Shiva. There's a story from the Padma Purana where he tells this story. So he relates how on the topmost peak of Mount Meru is Amaravati, which was built by Vishvakarma, where Lord Indra, along with his wife Sachi, is served by the demigods. So this is Lord Shiva reciting in Padma Purana the story. So one day, while Lord Indra is sitting peacefully, he sees that one very beautiful person has arrived, whom the servants of Lord Vishnu were serving. So when Lord Indra saw that very beautiful person, or young person, it specifically specifies, he fell from his throne onto the ground. And at that time, the demigods who'd been worshipping him, the same Lord Indra who just fell to the ground, they picked up his crown and placed it on the head of the new, very beautiful person. And after that, all the demigods and the other denizens of the heavenly planets started to perform artik and sing wonderful songs to that new King Indra. That was how the transition happened. And Lord Indra himself started to think, but this person has never built any wells or dug kuns or planted trees for the welfare of others. And when there were droughts, he did not provide grains in charity. He never performed any fire sacrifices or given great charities in the holy places. So how has he managed to obtain my seat? So the old Lord Indra asked himself this question. And the story goes on. At that time, Lord Vishnu gives the response. And this is what Lord Vishnu says. My dear Indra, that great soul has performed the recitation daily of the 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita every day during his life. He recited 5 shlokas from this chapter. And because of that activity, he has obtained the results of all sorts of pious activities and yagyas, and after enjoying for many years as the king of heaven, he will attain my divine abode. And then a little bit later, Lord Indra, the old Lord Indra, goes to a particular place, finds a brahmana to teach him the 18th chapter. So after Lord Indra had practiced the recitation from the 18th chapter for some time, he managed to attain Vishnu Loka. When he attained that place, he realized the pleasure he had enjoyed as King Indra, along with the demigods, was nothing in comparison. So this is Lord Shiva from the Gita Mahatmya of Padma Purana telling this story. And it's to illustrate something of why there's the emphasis on making the purposeful end of one's existence, the pleasure of the Supreme Lord. Now, there's another component to Lord Shiva's action when he's performing this act of ingesting the poison. And this is the other component. He says, it is my duty to give protection and safety to all living entities struggling for existence. Certainly, it is the duty of the master to protect his suffering dependents. So this was in the 38th verse of the same chapter. So Lord Shiva's knowledge is that, which was one of the things he's seen to possess by the demigods in their description of him, is that those engaged in benevolent activities for others is recognized by the Supreme Lord. And this particular understanding or knowledge that Lord Shiva has is borne out by the verse quoted by Srila Prabhupada. It's Bhagavad Gita 1868. Ya idam paramam gayam mad bhaktesya avidasyati bhakti mai param kritva mam evasyati ashamayaha. For one who explains the supreme secret to the devotees, pure devotional service is guaranteed. And at the end, he will come back to me. So, one can understand Lord Shiva is explaining a particular intricacy of devotional service, both to his wife Bhavani, and he's shown an example to all the demigods and entire humanity. And by showing such an example, again, he's pointing to that purposeful end, that persons be ready to accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because the verse of Bhagavad Gita is saying that it's necessary to give some intricacy of devotional service, particularly to the devotees or those who are ready to accept Krishna. Because otherwise, you know, it goes right over somebody's head, because it's a very intricate detail. And that intricate detail that Lord Shiva is imparting is, of course, that by performing the benevolent action, there's going to be recognition by the Supreme Lord. And what this does, by imparting this knowledge by his particular action, and even saying it directly to his wife Bhavani, it allows his wife, the demigods, any human, because it's also meant for humanity, provided the members of the human population are willing to accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it allows all those persons to move forward in their devotional activities. So just having somebody explain a particular intricacy of devotional life like Lord Shiva has done allows everyone to move forward in their devotional activities because one remembers that particular intricacy that was imparted by a great personality, as was the case with Lord Shiva. And one gets some understanding of the consequence as it transpires with these great personalities in the presence of Lord Shiva, because it's described in the verse, the next verse we read. Upon hearing of this act, everyone, including Bhavani, the daughter of Maharaj Daksha, Lord Brahma, Lord Vishnu, and the people in general, very highly praise this deed performed by Lord Shiva, who is worshipped by the demigods and who bestows benedictions upon people. So, praising Lord Shiva means the heart opens. One is ready to understand. So, Lord Shiva himself, which is the other part to look at, by his performing the action, he's serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead as a matter of duty. So he does it as a matter of duty because he sees that everybody's dependent upon him and he sees that everybody's in a state of suffering, so dutifully he performs the action. And the reason he's able to perform such a hugely magnanimous action of saving the entire universe is that he's in a particular position. His position is that of Sudasattva, a pure goodness, just as the demigods are described as being. But Lord Vishnu, but Lord Shiva in particular is very much working under the internal potency of Lord Krishna or Lord Vishnu. So it means that it's already been revealed in his heart what action he has to perform. So the external direction from Lord Vishnu came to the demigods to request it of Lord Shiva, but Lord Shiva already, by virtue of being in such a state of pure goodness, he actually understood what action he had to perform. So it, one could almost say, had the demigods not requested him, he would have understood he has to perform that action. So so Lord Shiva's action is being performed under the guidance of the internal potency of Lord Vishnu or Lord Krishna in the heart. And he describes this himself, because Lord Shiva says, I'm always engaged in offering obeisances to Lord Vasudev in pure Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is always pure consciousness in which the Supreme Personality of Godhead, known as Vasudev, is revealed without any covering. This is from Srimad Bhagavatam in the fourth canto and the third chapter and 23rd verse, where Lord Shiva is actually describing what position he's in. So Lord Shiva's heart is always filled with that concept of Vasudev, or the Supreme Person. And because of Vasudev, or the Supreme Person's presence within his heart and mind, Lord Shiva is always offering obeisances to the Supreme Person, constantly. And and hence it is that the Supreme Person is satisfied by the transcendental loving service offered by his devotee, Lord Shiva, and so he reveals himself. So these are some particular thoughts on just trying to expand a little bit on this very thorough purport of Srila Prabhupada's fourth verse that we read today. So if there's any thoughts to expand the discussion, may go ahead.
Thank you, Mataji, for your class. You made some nice points. My question and comments kind of related to, actually I was here in Bhagavatam class yesterday and I heard TJ mention a point of compassion because he was very emotional, so that kind of, you know, stuck with me and it kind of inspired me with some points. I thought it was good because I wrote some references down, so maybe you could answer some questions and expand the conversation. So one thing I appreciated One of my favorite verses that I appreciate in the Uddhava Gita is chapter 13, verse 37. It mentions charity, but charity is the same as welfare or compassion. So it mentions what's the greatest charity. It says the greatest charity is to give up all envy towards others. Because we can see in the material world, it's very easy to be compassionate to those who are suffering and less fortunate than ourselves, those who are suffering. But it's much harder to be compassionate toward those who are more successful than us. And so that's why I really appreciated this verse. And we can see in the material world that envy usually arises when someone is receiving recognition that we don't, that we think don't deserve recognition. And I'll kind of mention this past time. In this past time, the verse after the one today, it mentions that Shiva was glorified. And earlier in this chapter, it also mentions that Shiva, it mentions the past time where Shiva gave the Bhagavatam class with his wife on his lap. And there was celibate monks and renunciates in the audience. So naturally, if I'm a celibate and Shiva's giving a class with his wife on his lap, I'm going to be envious. And there's a similar situation with Ramananda Roy. This is in Anchalila chapter 5. So it mentions that one particular verse, Anchalila chapter 5, verse 84, this pastime mentions that just to vanquish the false pride of renunciates and learned scholars, Lord Chaitanya spoke religious principles through a sudra, Ramananda Roy, because to explain that, you know, in this pastime particularly, it mentions that Ramananda Roy in this pastime, his character was questionable. He was actually training some dancing girls. He was massaging their body with oil, their naked body. And his question is very questionable. But we could see in our society that we're not giving Bhagavatam class with our girlfriend or wife on our lap. We're not massaging girls with oil. Nor are we former prostitutes. Even it's described that even prostitutes are getting, you know, recognition, are advanced in spiritual life. But naturally, we want to consider authorities. So my question essentially is that naturally, there's kind of basically two authorities, official and unofficial. Naturally, the unofficial authorities like Ramananda Roy or the illiterate Brahmana, he's an unofficial authority. Most people didn't consider him authority. So naturally, sometimes we're inspired by official authorities and sometimes unofficial authorities. And a lot of times there's a conflict between that. So my question is essentially is that, what is a person to do if they ask us, can you guarantee me that if I listen to this official authority and not this unofficial authority, I won't fall down? Can you guarantee me I will not fall down? Because we can see that Prabhupada, or Bhaktisiddhanta, they had disciples, they were official authorities, but they still couldn't prevent their disciples from falling down, some of them. So how do we give up this tendency to blame others that, okay, or, you know, think that we're Krishna, we're the controller, I could prevent someone from falling down if I'm an official authority? We can see that's not possible. So how does a person answer that question, that dilemma, which comes up all the time, is that, don't listen to this devotee, don't listen to that devotee. But if we ask this person, can you guarantee me I won't fall down? Then how do we answer that question? So that's kind of my essential question. How does someone answer that question if it comes up, which it may come up? Can you guarantee me I won't fall down? Because naturally people listen to who they're inspired by, whether people consider them authoritative or not. So sorry, I kind of elaborated on that, but maybe you could expand on some of those points, very important points.
So the question, as I understood it, is a person may, you drew two categories of persons. You said you labeled them, one as official devotees and one as unofficial devotees, at least in terms of external actions. And then, or position, and then you wanted to know, particularly if one is taking some instruction from either of those two categories of persons, how could one be assured that if, I presume the underlying thing which you didn't express was, how could one be sure that the instruction one is taking from either of those two categories would guarantee that one doesn't fall down from one's Krishna consciousness. Okay.
A tendency to naturally people's going to listen to, if I'm inspired by Krishna from whatever authority, it doesn't matter, unofficial, unofficial, whether you're in this position or that position, that's natural. Wherever I'm feeling the most love, wherever I'm feeling someone's increasing my faith in Krishna, so it doesn't matter. So naturally that's the tendency, that's a law of nature and we can't prevent that. So maybe you could expand on that question. How can we guarantee that, you know?
All right.
Thank you.
So, I'm not sure that I could go with the particular categorization that you created, that there's official and unofficial devotees, because the categorization implied that the activities of some devotees would appear to be rather unusual, and they couldn't be classified officially as devotees on the basis of their activities. So the examples you gave was Ramananda Roy teaching dancing and also being engaged in whatever's necessary for the maintenance of those dancing girls, because I think generally a person who dances has to have some massages to allow for the body to function properly, because there's a lot of strain on the body. So you put that devotee or that example into a category of devotees that may not be classified as devotees by virtue of their external activities. Now, why I wouldn't agree with your particular categorization of devotees into official and unofficial categories by virtue of their actions is because it's a very external view of a devotee. So the external view is what's one's observing by one's senses, means one's taking in with one's eyes the particular activity, or one's getting some understanding based on some concepts that one is holding within one's mind. So there's a preconception. Oh, a devotee who is now a renunciate is teaching dancing to young women, so this puts the person into a category where he doesn't qualify as a devotee, so unofficial devotee, that's how you put it. That external view is based on the preconceptions that one is imposing on that devotee who's performing that particular service. So it wouldn't be accurate to rely on that judgment or that view of the devotee purely based on the activities performed and that one is judging with one's pre-held concepts. Rather, it would be best to indeed seek the shelter of a devotee that, let's say, with the concepts one is holding, one can see externally, perceptibly, this person can be classified as a devotee, performs regular devotional activities, which may be, you know, one sees that person chanting, one sees that person worshipping the deity, one sees that person studying the scriptures. So one goes to such a person that, according to one's concept of a devotee, fits that picture and asks that person, the concepts I'm holding of this devotee who's performing these activities are causing me to dismiss this person from the category of being a devotee of Lord Krishna by virtue of their activities. Can you please assist me to adjust my concepts because I want to give the benefit of the doubt to this devotee? According to the concepts I hold, this person doesn't fall into the category of a devotee. So one would have to be approach it more without a mood of judgment and understanding that it's one's mind that is bringing about the judgment. So if one uses that approach and goes to that devotee that one, you know, accepts is, as you called it, an official devotee, then that person can actually give one more insight into looking beyond what is externally visible. So if one looks beyond what is externally visible, one may learn, actually, this great personality is performing the actions under the order of their spiritual master, their superior. And that particular activity that person is performing, because it's been performed under the order of the spiritual master, is completely a purifying activity. It's actually an activity of devotion to the Supreme Lord, because that person acting under the order of the spiritual master is getting purified of any material contamination. So that would be the way to proceed to assist oneself, because it would be a grave offense to dismiss somebody from the category of being a devotee without having first consulted somebody else, and one shouldn't rely exclusively on one's own mind and its judgment by the externals. So then, to answer your question of how is it that one could be certain that if one takes what somebody is actually saying to oneself, some instruction, that instruction is going to allow one to remain steady on the path of devotional life, that it won't cause one to abandon devotional life. So, well, naturally, the instruction would have to be taken from somebody that is understood in general to be a person on the path of Krishna consciousness, a person who's trying to elevate their consciousness, a person who's genuinely working for the benefit of others. And that's generally understood because a reputation precedes a person. It's very easy to clarify who is such a person. And if one is in some doubt, one can even go to the highest authority, who's one's spiritual master, and say, can I take an instruction from person X? And the spiritual master may give it consideration, because the spiritual master will also consider what one's capacity to receive, or who's the personality from whom one has the capacity to receive. Because one may not be able to hear from many devotees. It may be specific personalities that one truly can respect, that one will be able to hear from. So then, based on that direction, one can seek out the particular personality that one's advised to seek out and take direction from, and one can feel confident, specifically if that instruction came from the spiritual master, because the spiritual master has insight into the way one's mind functions and the particular preconceptions one has. And so the spiritual master will very expertly arrange that the person chosen that one can take instruction from will have insight into the preconceptions one has. And so that person will be able to advise one in such a nice way that almost effortlessly one will be able to drop those preconceptions and then see a devotee in the proper light. That's an attempt to answer your question. And Jaini Tagore Hari had a question.
To place my question in context first, I'll try and reiterate some of the things I was taking from your class. One was that Lord Shiva's purposeful end was out of his unalloyed desire to serve the Supreme Lord. And you were saying that he was also in this position of Suddha Sattva, this pure mode of goodness. And that's due to that position of that purposeful end of that, just that desire to just serve the Supreme Lord. And it was also, as I understand, elucidated in that pastime with Lord Indra, where, you know, there's the devotee who was just reading chapter 18 of Bhagavad Gita because that was so pleasing to the Lord. Whereas Lord Indra, he said, well, you know, I give all these grains, I give all this water, I perform all these sacrifices, you know, what's he doing for people? And this is the reason why even Lord Shiva, he's saying, my desire is to serve the Supreme Lord, and because the Supreme Lord is satisfied, then all living entities are satisfied. He's not saying, I'll satisfy all living entities out of my compassion, then the Supreme Lord will be satisfied. That order is important in that context. So the question comes in for me is that because Lord Shiva is on this Suddha Sattva platform, and he really truly understands the transcendental nature of his activities, so, and Krishna's in his heart, so it's very clear to him that this activity is pleasing to the Supreme Lord. And therefore, this is naturally compassion. Now, as a sadhana bhakta, we are performing these activities, and we don't necessarily see the transcendental nature of those activities, and our consciousness is a bit mixed. Yet, in terms of having a relationship with Krishna and the relationship with the devotees, and in terms of this consciousness of this desire to please, some sentiment is necessary. I even remember reading it in Nectar of Devotion. I mean, even though there's this huge emphasis on Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, it mentions this necessary for that sentiment. Some sentiment is necessary. And I was a bit shocked to read this because I was on the platform, this idea of, you know, no sentimentalism, you know, do your duty. And so how does one, the question is, I guess my first question, there's another one that's a bit more personal, but my first question is, how does one cultivate that sentiment in a healthy manner without it, I guess, diluting the philosophical understanding of what's happening? Is that a clear question?
Okay. So the question you're posing is based on the understanding that there has to be some sentiment in performing devotional activity. And that sentiment, naturally based on what's having drawn from some of the points said in the class, has to be directed towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because that was the order in which Lord Shiva was doing things. First, please the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and then other entities will be pleased, the demigods, humanity at large. And your question is trying to understand how one cultivates that sentiment in a way that is healthy? Okay. So you brought up that you were recognizing the mention that Lord Shiva is in a transcendental position. He's in pure goodness. So that would imply that his judgment of what activities to perform was mentioned in the class too. is very much guided by being very much in touch with Super Soul, the Lord Vishnu in the heart. And so, therefore, his expression of sentiment towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead is in a very pure state. There's pure love. One understands that by virtue of his position and his intimate connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there's that love, and then he has to perform some action that's going to be benefiting people in general. And it says, actually, that Lord Shiva, forget the exact quote, he actually is friendly to all living entities. So he's carrying some sentiment of friendliness towards all living entities. So in his case, clearly the friendly sentiment towards all living entities isn't going to override that prime end of pleasing the Supreme Personality of God. So he's first going to check in before he performs his action. What is the indication from Lord Vishnu in the heart, Super Soul in the heart, of what action is the correct action to perform? And it's confirmed externally too. The demigods come and say to him, indirectly, they don't say to him, please drink the poison, that obviously wouldn't be correct. So indirectly they praise him as indeed being the Super Soul in all entities. So they're praising his particular position, and so they need to please him, and from his position, so they're expressing the correct sentiment towards him. You know, obviously it's with good judgment. And in his particular position, he's responding because he understands, and he explains it in his own words. He's speaking to his wife, and he says, you know, these poor persons, this is how he puts it, my dear gentle wife Bhavani, when one performs benevolent activities for us and for others, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Hari is very pleased, and when the Lord is pleased, I'm also pleased, along with all other living creatures. Therefore, let me drink this poison, for all the living entities may thus become happy because of me. And that statement is based on the understanding. He says, just see how all these living entities have been placed in danger because of the poison produced from the churning of the ocean of milk. So Lord Shiva is recognizing the necessity for the action to be performed. His sentiment always, though, is that sentiment of his relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he doesn't actually have the mode of passion set in where now he must spring into action and immediately use his mystic powers, condense that poison to a palmful, and just go ahead. Rather, he reflects first. And you notice how he's actually takes time. He's reflecting first. Oh, all the living entities have been put into danger. Oh, okay. So the first order of the day is I must please the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then all the other living entities will be pleased. I must drink the poison. Very reflective mode of goodness. If he were influenced by a mode of passion, he would have just sprung into action. Ah, everybody's in danger. Let me now rescue everyone. Didn't function in the mode of passion. Very reflective. So the cultivation of the sentiment, returning to your question, towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is facilitated, understanding that that sentiment is to be one of loving affection or a development of friendship or servitude or a particular mood towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is facilitated by having a mode of goodness position. So the mode of goodness position is always one of stepping back and reflecting, examining the situation very carefully before one springs into action. The proper reflection is essential, because that will allow for that proper perspective, the proper priority being there, and also the it will facilitate the that loving mood towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because when one is giving proper reflection to any matter, one will be inclined to perhaps seek some advice and hear some confirmation that what one is thinking to do is the correct course of action. So that kind of reflection is mode of goodness, a mode of goodness stance, and it will give one the strength and the proper perspective in springing into action to deal with a particular situation. If all of that is not there and one merely springs into action, there's always dire consequences, because as you pointed out yourself, the sequence, the priority has to be correct. So the correct priority is always looking, will this action be pleasing to the Supreme Personality of Godhead? And certainly the action that's pleasing to the Supreme Personality of Godhead may be very contrary to an action that wasn't performed from a position of mode of goodness, or being in a way of being this, in a mode of being, functioning in a way that is mode of goodness versus functioning in a way where one is impelled by the mind in a more passionate way, or even perhaps conditioned in some way with some ignorance. So that would be the way to cultivate the proper sentiment, even, because with getting advice, being reflective, setting the correct priority, it increases the loving mood towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because one realizes that, oh, actually, this is quite a glorious act to perform, because one is getting the confirmation from other devotees, one is positioning oneself correctly, aligning oneself with the desire of the Supreme Lord. So automatically, everything's very auspicious and conducive to the health and happiness, not only of oneself, but to everyone. And it's a completely different position to the one where one eliminates the reflective component and just springs into action, conditioned by passion or ignorance, or even goodness, maybe. The transcendental goodness, the reflective state is the proper one. Thank you very much for the question. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. All glories to Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.